Hello, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here, Veritas Medical. VeritasMedical.com is where you can find these archive shows. We've got a great show today. The moment I heard the FDA was going to consider, a panel was convening to approve emergency use authorization of the COVID-19 gene therapy injections, I thought, I've got to get Dr. Paula Alexander on the show. We've had Steve Kirsch, we've had Dr. Jessica Cook, we've had Dr. Peter McCullough. Many of these folks have testified to the FDA committees prior, like for the booster shot in particular, when that was voted down. Dr. Alexander was one of those experts testifying. And my hope was that some expert testimony and letters and emails to the FDA committee would result in them not approving or recommending the emergency use of this vaccine. But alas, it did not. We're recording this show today, November 3rd. Last night or yesterday, the FDA went ahead and approved for 5 to 11-year-olds. So what great timing to have Dr. Paul Alexander join us today. Dr. Alexander is an expert in clinical epidemiology. He's also an expert in evidence-based medicine with education at Oxford, also McMaster University. He was a advisor through the Health and Human Services Department to President Trump regarding COVID. So Dr. Alexander is well-versed in not only looking at data, but he's also well-versed about the entire COVID-19 pandemic and the response to that. So we're excited to have him on the show. Welcome, Dr. Alexander. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, and I look forward to providing some input. It's a difficult period right now, so I think right now we want to share as much information as we can.
Yes, sir. I'd like to frame the conversation a little bit and get your perspective, and you can go into as much detail as you'd like. I definitely want to focus on these 5 to 11-year-olds that just got emergency authorized use approved. But framing the whole COVID-19 conversation, because you were there at the beginning, and please tell our listeners a little bit about that if you want, but I'm talking about the entire response, the initial response, the response, you know, halfway through when we had more data and we knew we were looking at something that was amenable to treatment. But let's just walk through and kind of frame the conversation first. So if you don't mind, take us back to those first days and how you got involved with the Trump administration in advising them.
Well, I mean, you introduced my background, and so around the mid of 2019, WHO, Geneva, and PAHO, Washington, Pan American Health, had asked me to provide technical input and expertise in building a training program for low and middle income countries on issues around evidence-based medicine, how to conduct basic research for developing countries, and a training program. So whilst working on that around January, when these things began, when the situation began to emerge in China and Italy, Lombardia, etc., they asked me to pivot my role as a pandemic advisor, because COVID pandemic advisor, because of my background in evidence-based medicine and research methods, to try to understand, help them understand any of the research that was being done globally and what COVID was about, etc. And particularly if there's a possibility to treat. And, well, in everything, in terms of surge capacity, putting out messages and information to their member countries across the world, but generally to the global public. So my role actually was advising WHO as a COVID pandemic advisor. And whilst doing it, I became very proficient on COVID because I was informing WHO and PAHO. So I had to learn and read everything and study up everything and write for them. I got a telephone call from Washington people without getting into details as to who and how, but basically asking me that some of my work and statements and writing had come across the White House and the highest levels of government. And they were very interested in things that I had to see and my approach and would I be interested in joining the administration behind the scenes, working at Health and Human Services, providing technical input in any which way I could. So I went to D.C. and I worked there at Health and Human Services, which is actually just across the street, if you know the area, from the Capitol building and down the street from the White House. And my job was basically to provide technical input on everything that was going on. It was very difficult because it was Washington. It's a bureaucratic place, very political, the most vicious, banal press in the world. I wouldn't say how I feel about the press on the show. So it was a very, very harrowing experience because I took my family with me. And it was more trying to navigate the politics than to actually get the science done. So much so that a lot of people don't understand that when I got there, I had soon after resigned from my position at WHO and PAHO because I couldn't retain both as a conflict, although persons in the White House asked me to see if I could maintain the relationship for a cross-collaboration, how we can share. And the WHO asked me the same thing. So we're in a kind of discussion where I was in the middle. Because of my expertise, once there was no sharing of any sensitive information, how we could have collaborated through me. But it became untenable because the folk at WHO were more interested in the politics of my situation and how they could use my position to actually hurt President Trump. And I wouldn't allow that. So I resigned that position whilst I held a position in Health and Human Services. But what people didn't understand with all of the garbage that the press writes about people and attacks, when it became known that I was working in the Trump administration, it was an attack on me to get me to quit. So much so that the bureaucracy, when I got there, for a very long while, refused to complete my my official hire. So I was in Washington, I was working at HHS, I was going into the White House, yet I had no formal appointment, but everybody knew who I was. And also they made a decision to not pay me. So a lot of people don't understand. And when the press writes their filth, they don't understand the sacrifices that people made. I had my family with me. I had press people threatening me. I had them having people follow me. I had them threatening my life, my family's life. The security had to move me to Virginia, to Maryland, to move me because of threats, because I was trying to help the nation with my skills and expertise. They asked me, and I left where I was to go to D.C., but I wasn't being paid. People didn't know that. I was given my time for free because I wanted to help. I got paid in the last month or so, first paycheck from the last month, and it's actually the Department of Defense that paid me. Because people realize that this guy, and it is true, was being treated like filth. Why? Because it was told to me, you're working for President Trump, so the knives are out for you. Anyone, whatever you're doing. And that's what I dealt with whilst trying to wrestle with the science. So anyway, that's that, so you understand. I came highly credentialed. I have a degree. I did graduate master's work at York University in Canada. I did a master's degree in epidemiology at the University of Toronto. I did some graduate level work in biological warfare at Johns Hopkins. I did a master's degree in clinical epidemiology and evidence-based medicine at Oxford. I did a doctorate at McMaster in evidence-based medicine and clinical epidemiology under Dr. Gordon Guyatt, who invented the field of evidence-based medicine. I did my postdoc with him. So yeah, I went with a lot of credentials, very much, and I wanted to give it, and I ended up giving most for free. And my approach was like Dr. Scott Atlas's approach, which was this. You do not lock down the society indefinitely. In fact, you didn't lock down the society at all. The lockdowns were a catastrophic failure, all of them. We found, I did the research with the team that I was on, not one instance up to today where any lockdown worked. Any lockdown in any society, in any setting. In fact, the lockdowns worked to cause death, to harm people. We found not one instance where mass mandates worked. In not one instance. In fact, mass mandates drive infection. We found not one instance where closing schools stopped infection, etc. In fact, children were at very low risk to begin with, but closing schools were catastrophic on children, especially the poor children in America. It killed people, poor children in Canada, in Britain, everywhere. Children committed suicide because of the lockdowns and the school closure. People didn't understand this, and that was the data that we were getting. The news wouldn't report the official situation because of the lockdowns and school closure, because Trump was trying to open his society, and give him a lot of credit for that. He was fighting the task force to open up and open schools because he was seeing what we were seeing. We were getting reports out of the states that little children were hanging themselves in America. But the news wouldn't talk about it because it would have given him a win. So my job, like Atlas and other people, was to try and bring balance and fairness to the situation and try to see that what worked before is what will work then and what still will work today, which is you strongly and properly protect the vulnerable in society first. Nothing happens unless you do that. You protect the vulnerable, that's the elderly and the high-risk people. And you use whatever means you need, creative means within your private homes, within nursing homes, assisted living, long-term. We failed to do that. We still failed to do that. Our nursing homes became killing fields because we failed to stop the staff from entering them who were infected. The staff took the infections and still do into the nursing homes and killed thousands of people across the world. Not deliberately. I would leave history and whomever to sort that out, and the bureaucracy and the nursing unions and the old age home unions and whomever and whoever made the money, etc. Because we told them the staff were moving to multiple places, entering into the homes, and the staff don't really get paid much. So I understand they were etching out a living. But they were bringing infection into the homes and killing our parents and grandparents. And no one did anything about it. And that's a fact. That's what the data shows. So we never, ever did what we needed to do, which was strongly protect the elderly first. Once you do that in an epidemic or a pandemic, and we even had early treatment available to us where we could treat those high-risk people. So if Granny was in a nursing home, and you strongly protected her, you're making sure not everybody could come and visit Granny until we get this under control. You're making sure that the staff are not coming in to infect her and kill her. You have early treatment available. And you give Granny it if she's infected so that she doesn't degenerate and go along the COVID sequelae, does not need to go to hospital or does not need to die. Because the early treatment we saw in the research was cutting the risk of hospitalization and death by 90%. Your risk of death from the time you touched the emergency room door went from 38 to 40%, 28-day mortality. So we knew that if you're an elderly, high-risk person and you enter the hospital along the COVID train, you have a strong chance that you were not going to leave, which was the situation. So we were trying to keep people from entering the hospital, and that's the purpose of early treatment. So once you protect the vulnerable, you provide early treatment, which is what I was saying, you allow the rest of society with reasonable, common sense decisions to live largely an unfettered life with no heavy footprint from the government. You as least as possible interrupt the society, and you let the healthy and the well people in society, the children, the young people, the middle-aged, even the older people who are healthy and well, you let them live a largely unfettered life normally, making common sense decisions, taking reasonable safety precautions. so that the economy goes on and people's lives go on. We lost hundreds of thousands of people in this world because of the nonsensical, illogical, irrational, absurd lockdowns and school closures that had no basis, none. Never did, still does not. But we were attacked for what I just said, because the idiots in the news and in the different task forces didn't stop to listen to what we were saying. If you listen to the entirety, particularly like the Great Barrington Declaration by Bhattacharya and Kulloff and Gupta, etc., simple. We wanted a very age-restratified approach, a focused protection. You don't implement a carte blanche approach to a situation like this when you could focus on high-risk people, target them, use mitigation steps for them, and you allow the rest of society to function normally. And that was the approach, and that was what we were attacked for. Still remains the approach.
Can you expand a little bit more on that early treatment and give me your opinion? You know, on hydroxychloroquine in particular, we know Dr. Zev Zelenko started using that early on. We know President Trump mentioned it. Then the Lancet article came out and subsequently retracted. Can you give your opinion on that whole situation?
Well, I mean, look, this pandemic, look, let me tell you something. I went to, you can hear from my voice, I'm an immigrant originally to the United States and Canada. I have a lot of black family. My heritage is colored. I'm fair-skinned, but my heritage is colored. So people were kind of amazed. Oh, you work for President Trump. Well, all of my experiences with President Trump in that White House, when I went and who I dealt with, were excellent, very respectful. I encountered no instances of racism, because that's the first thing people, they want to know, did they treat you racially, or did you ever feel offended, etc. That's a whole load of bull. This became a political response. It moved quickly from a public health response. And everyone worked against Trump. I saw. I know. I listened. I can't discuss where I was or who I met with, but I was in the highest levels of meeting, and I listened to different people in the task force. I knew what was going on. The effort was not to work with Trump and open his society and open schools. It was to damage him. This was really what this became. Whether or not it started like that, it morphed into that. It was a political response. So everything was done through a political lens. So if Trump said A, they would do B. If he said B, they would go back to A. And they would use the press to do it. So it was garbage what they were doing, because they were killing people in the country. Because you couldn't wrap your arms around the response properly, because you constantly were dealing with the politics and the press. And the issue around early treatment, well, you're a clinician. Doctors, at the end of this, doctors not only going to hang their heads in shame, history will record. And it is my hope that we go back in time when this is done, however long more this garbage continues. Because a lot of this is a fraud, what is happening still. But when this is done, I want somehow in a proper legal forum, with the proper legal smart people, smarter than me, to go back in time and find exactly who did what. Who were involved with what? With lockdowns, with everything that they did. Everything with early treatment. Go back in time, find them. Take them into a legal forum and get them to explain. And if it could be shown ever that you did wrong deliberately and you harmed people's lives, I want you dealt with legally at the highest levels. I want all of your income taken away. I want any way that you benefited stripped, taken away. Your home, your every single thing. Because these people killed people by their decisions. That task force you watched there were people on that task force who their policies against Trump killed people. Killed Americans. And they did that with early treatment because they knew that early treatment worked. It was nonsensical to think that as a viral infection, where normally you go to a clinician and you have a condition, doctor does not send you home with nothing and tell you go home and twiddle. The doctor uses some kind of empiric treatment at least, so you could get through it and start some treatment. They knew that this virus with with the viral replication phase, if you get in there early with any kind of good antiviral, you could probably do some damage to the virus and start the repair process, or even stop the viral replication, stop the sequelae onto hyperinflammatory process, the pulmonary phase, the fluid pneumonia, and all of that. They knew that. Yet the game was to stop the use of any of the early treatments and to prevent any kind of success. This was about preventing any kind of success. This was about preventing the media from, say, giving Trump any success, any. So if he spoke about hydroxy, well, they have to damage it. If he spoke about ivermectin, they have to damage it. If he spoke about anything, they had to damage it. And these people knew. It is like with natural immunity. Before even the first vaccine, they started to throw out a bunch of garbage, cherry picking suboptimal crap studies telling us, oh, well, we've seen these COVID people who had COVID that their immunities, when their antibodies are waning, so they're losing their immunity. These scientists on the task force, these Fauci and these frauds, these doctors across the world who are pimping for their research grants, standing on the side, doing nothing. I'm so ashamed of them. Many of them I did research with at McMaster and all across the world. They have to be held accountable for what they've done. They knew that when your antibody levels in your blood, you know this, falls and wanes. It doesn't mean you're losing your immunity, but they use that to help scare the public to continue the lockdown and wait for the vaccines, and to drive in your head that vaccine was the only way out. Suboptimal vaccine that is demonstrating that it's failed. But they knew. They knew that your immune response is not just antibodies in the blood. Your cellular immunity was a key component, B cell and T cells. You know this. You know that the B cells differentiate into long-lived bone marrow plasma cells for life that will churn up antibodies again when you get re-exposed. They knew this. These doctors and scientists didn't know this. Fauci and Burks, and they did not know this. But it was all part of a scheme. And it's a horrid scheme, because at the end they killed people. People died. When Fauci and Burks went on Sanjay Gupta, CNN, 3 months ago or 4 months ago, and stated that the 400,000 people who died at that point, when they were transitioning to the new government, we should blame this on President Trump. Well, I want to ask them today, what about the 400 more thousand, because it's now 800,000. Are you going to blame Biden? Because it's been his shop. We have had 400,000 more deaths under him. Every single policy President Trump implemented was based on what Fauci and Burks told him. He did nothing unless he got guidance from them. He depended on them for guidance, high-level technical guidance. When he shut down, it was because of them. They stated that. They told him, shut down the economy. Today, I will say, and even back then, President Trump made a grave mistake not firing all of them instantly when he came into power and instantly when they came onto that task force. He made a grave mistake. They damaged America with their policies, not President Trump's policies. He followed what they said, as a CEO. They implemented catastrophic policies that hurt America and killed people. I say it bluntly, they killed people. And I hope one day everyone, even down to a simple doctor who refused to treat their patient, a patient died or got sick and was harmed, who forced these vaccines, not properly consented and understanding that the vaccines are suboptimal and that the vaccines are causing adverse events and deaths. Look, I'll vote for President Trump again. I worked in his administration as an immigrant. I responded to the request to come to Washington because I appreciated what he was doing for colored persons in America, for black people, for brown people, for immigrants, for minorities with the economic success. I saw people's lives transform. They had hope. He did that. I give him a lot of credit. But I also say in this call that the vaccine was the biggest catastrophic public health fiasco and disaster. I could see nothing right with it. Nothing. And right now, we're on the hill right now fighting against children, because children under no condition, none, should be given these vaccines. They bring no risk to the table, no appreciable risk, statistical zero. Yet the vaccines provide no benefit.
Excuse me, Dr. Alexander, we got to get a quick break in here for a commercial. We will be right back, guys. We're with Dr. Paul Alexander. You can check out his articles, his op-eds. He writes for brownstone.org. And stick with us. I'm Ben Edwards, you're the cure. Okay, we are back with Dr. Paul Alexander. So we were talking about adverse events. So let's dive into VAERS. And like I said, we've had Steve Kirsch, Jessica Rose on the show talking about some of these adverse events. Can you speak to VAERS? Because some public officials and physicians alike will say, well, these deaths are just would have happened anyways. And there's no causality. And I mean, there's multiple different answers they'll give. But let's talk about these adverse reactions and these VAERS reports and the accuracy of VAERS. Do you have a thought or an opinion, or what's the evidence say about that?
Well, I mean, you know that from the science, there are actually published literature that shows that if VAERS captures between zero, well, from 1% to 10%, some say as much as 30%. Of the actual burden out there, whether adverse effects or deaths. So we need to look at the reporting right now through those lens. So let's handicap it to say VAERS captures 20%. Right now, VAERS is reporting about 18,000 deaths post-vaccine, 1 to 2 days or about 5 days post-vaccine. Most of them are about 5 days. So if it's 20%, right, you're talking about 90 to 100,000 deaths thus far from the vaccine. VAERS is reporting about 800,000 adverse events. So you're probably talking about maybe a couple million. Remember, the usual vigilance surveillance system in Europe right now is reporting about 30,000 deaths and about 2 to 3 million adverse events. So the reality, too, is that the CDC, this is CDC's database, and for the submission to be retained, the CDC has to check it and vet it. So this is not just people in the society just putting anything in there. It's being checked. So it's a credible system, but a suboptimal system. And that has to be changed in terms of, we need a proper surveillance because we don't have a proper understanding. The reality about it is that, look, these vaccines seem to be working well for some people, but it's not working well for many people. And the many people it's not working well for are the ones who get adverse events and die. And that's a fact. And I know people in my own life, in my own family or friends, who've had an allergic reaction, severe, and I know a couple that have died. Many people now know people. So that's a very alarming thing. Okay? And it boggles the mind as to how a pause hasn't been put or slowed down, or you must stop to understand what's happening. And the public just has to understand one thing. We take 10 to 12 to 15 years. There is no way that you could do something that takes 15 years normally and boil it down into 3 to 4 months and tell me that you did not cut corners. They cut many corners with this. And I know President Trump is going to have to at some point turn and actually discuss that this vaccine program was bad and that he made a mistake. He made a mistake. They stuck at him and snowed him. This can't be right. It was not needed to begin with. We could have dealt with this situation with no vaccine, but they had to have cut corners. And when they told him, they did not. They lied to him. Moderna and Pfizer, they lied. Everything that they've done is a lie. Look, I was invited to a meeting at HHS. that involves the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, and everyone at the highest levels. I'm talking about the top of everyone and the vaccine developers. And we were discussing with the press. The press were giving a lot of pressure. I'm not going to discuss too many details, things I can't say, and who, etc. But I'll tell you something that I want to share so you understand how I understand this. When I got there, and I sat down, and I was introduced, and everybody introduced, and the meeting started. It was a teleconference, and all of the press, CNN, Washington Post, New York, everybody was there on the line, teleconference. And then everybody had to declare their security clearance because it was a high-level meeting. It involved the military also, because the military were playing a very strong. They did actually a good job in logistics. And at that point, some of us had some kind of clearance, but not the level that was needed. I was one of them that my clearance was not at that time where it had to be in that meeting. I didn't understand it, given I was probably the only technical person sitting there, even more than these people from FDA and CDC. But several of us were asked to leave. So I left. When I left, one of the secretaries came to me and said, listen, a couple of people in the military want to ask you a couple of questions, because I was already in some of these meetings, Operation Warp Speed, giving my input on the methodology and different things. So I don't know. I didn't know who it was. So I said, well, what would I do? You know, I've been told to depart this meeting with these other people, so we're just going to go back to our office. And she said, no, just sit here and wait when the meeting is done. So I was sitting down outside the meeting, but I could hear the meeting. I'm not going to discuss the details, but I'll share one thing because it's very important for the American people to understand, or whomever who's interested. Somebody in the media asked, how could you be bringing this vaccine to market after 3 months to 4 months? And one of the vaccine developers, I will not say which one, but it was the actual head of the vaccine company, asked the head of the vaccine development, so the person, one of the people who were actually involved in the experiments and doing this, he was there to give his input. And he told the press and everyone sitting there, and these people are idiots. They're inept, incompetent fools, because they didn't understand the garbage he was saying. And he's a scientist, and he's supposed to know what he's saying. He told them, well, we know that is a concern, para, that we don't have the right amount of time to check for safety. We're not following it properly. But we have dealt with that by the large sample size. So I'm sitting down there and listening to this junk. I'm saying, well, what garbage is this guy saying? And they all lapped it up and moved on to the next question, because the press was peppering the administration. So this meeting was to try and pacify the press so they wouldn't derail the Operation Warp Speed. And this guy at the highest levels of his company just talked bullshit to the press and to all the other scientists. And the people in FDA, which is the highest levels there, the top level people were there, didn't understand the garbage he just said, and they just lapped it up. Or maybe they knew he was talking junk and went along. So I waited. I did wait. And when the meeting was over, I explained to some of the people outside that listen, that's junk, what that guy said in there. You can't circumvent time. You need the time to follow this up. Oh, well, then we're going to have to bring it circle. Using this term that they coined now, they use that back then. We'll circle back to him and we'll make sure he understands. I say, but you're not understanding. We almost finished this vaccine development. You cannot circumvent time. You cannot detect the safety signals. And I explained to them, I said, let me give it to you this way. If I were running two studies, one had a sample size of 1,000. I put 500 in each arm, 500 intervention, 500 placebo. The other study had 100,000 people, so massive, 50,000 intervention, 50,000 placebo. But a small study with just 1,000 people, you followed up, you ran that study for 2 years. The massive study with the 100,000, you ran it for just 6 months. And the safety signals and safety events you're looking for normally happens after about a year. Which one do you think you will get to detect those safety signals? Which one?
Yeah,
you will detect them in a small one, the small suboptimal one, but it at least will be able to show you the adverse effects. Furthermore, I explained to them, if you run the study for such a short period of time, and these adverse events take a long time to develop, what are you going to do after that when the public, the people who are in receipt of these drugs or vaccines or a medical device, whatever, what are you going to do? How could you bring that to market? But that was beyond my pay grade and my level. I was there as a technical scientist, but you could say what you want. You could give input. They don't necessarily need to listen. As I said, this became a political matter. So it's not a public health response. And I was on record saying I'm against these vaccines. I don't know your position. I'm just telling you mine. I still am. Only for the highest risk people and only if you properly consented. And still then I don't approve of them. Because if you look at the data today, you see the vaccines are pretty much ineffective against the Delta. And it's deranging the immune response in such a way that is biasing the immune response, so it's not working, and it's actually causing, if you look at the data out of the UK now and you study it properly, you could see, yes, the vaccinated are the ones getting infected predominantly. It is glaringly so. The vaccinated are becoming reinfected with the Delta more than the unvaccinated. However, the unvaccinated are showing a higher risk of death. The question is why? I am arguing that I think the vaccinated persons are spreading the infection and causing the unvaccinated to become infected, hospitalized, and dying. That's what the data shows me.
Well, all the data, I believe, is so skewed now in regards to early treatment and this thought that it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated versus a pandemic of the vaccinated now, looking at UK and Israel. But I think both those are misnomers. It's a pandemic of the untreated. And every person I hear about that's in the hospital or in the ICU, and I get emails every day from desperate families trying to get their loved one in the ICU to be able to have ivermectin. And every one of these, they were not treated early. They waited too late or got no treatment at all. And so that's my biggest take-home message. And I agree with you 100% on the ineffectiveness of the vaccine against Delta in particular. And the whole push has been it will decrease risk of hospitalization and death. Well, let's look at the decreased risk of hospitalization and death using early treatment that you alluded to earlier, an 85 to 90% reduction. So if you want to compare just those two outcomes, I think it's clear we have repurposed drugs with historical data of safety going back 40 years, 50 years, 60 years with hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. So it's really just a no-brainer if those are the outcomes you're trying to prevent. Can you, Dr. Alexander, I know you're going to have to run, but specifically, I have 6 children. My youngest is 4. My oldest is 18. I love kids, obviously. I think we all love kids. There are pediatricians in this town, obviously, that love kids too. Texas Tech Medical Center, full of physicians and administrators and decision makers, county health officials here in the local county health department. I just saw a news flash pop up on my phone. The local county health department will start offering the COVID-19 vaccine to 5-year-olds, 5 to 11-year-olds. It's going to be a big push. It's going to be on the news. It's going to be on billboards. It's going to be at schools. It's going to be propagandized as the mask were early on. These people locally I'm talking about, I think love kids just as much as I love kids, but we're on the polar opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to recommending this, where I would say it's medically contraindicated in children is how far, yes, I would go. I would call it even probably use the term malpractice because of the data. When there is no risk, these kiddos, I mean, from what I've seen, 400 to 600 kids a year die from influenza typically in an average year. Back in 2009, the swine flu H1N1, it was about 1,200 children died. And I haven't looked lately, but I think in the 18 months of COVID, when I did look a month or two ago, it was about 385 children had died, all with comorbidities, pre-existing conditions. But even at that, 385 in 18 months versus 400 to 600 a year from influenza, 1,200 back in 2009. So when there's no risk, I've heard you even talk about children should be considered already quote unquote vaccinated. They're naturally immune because of the ACE2 receptors and the B cells, yes, already, all that kind of stuff. So why, if a kid's not at any risk, why would you, even if it's only going to be 0.1% of the kids have an adverse reaction or death or myocarditis or whatever. And we know the numbers are worse than that on myocarditis in the teenagers, but why? There's number one, there's no emergency. How are you going to authorize an emergency use authorization when there's no emergency in this age group? And number two, no safety data. Since when do we put kids into experimental clinical trial, phase 3 clinical trial like this on a gene therapy? And the biggest beef I have, and then I'll let you speak, sorry, is the adverse reactions I have seen in children already. I already have parents calling me. They were not properly informed. To a man, so far, these parents have told me, and ask me, well, wasn't this just like a regular other childhood vaccine? They don't understand. It's gene therapy. The definition of vaccination was even changed. So there's lack of informed consent. There's no emergency in this age group. There is early effective treatment, but it's really not needed because there's no poor outcomes in this age group. It's less deadly than flu. So what say you to the local pediatricians, county health officials, medical school folks, and to parents that are considering this for their children because of the media push that's coming?
Well, I mean, everything that you just said, I echo. I mean, I published that op-ed and I showed 6 studies that show that there's a molecular biological basis that you should consider children already vaccinated and fully immune. And not just based on that, you know, I cited a work by Losk, I cited a work by Yang and Weisberg and these people, and they looked at the upper respiratory tract of kids, and they looked at B cell response already in their blood, and their T cell capability already. So, but not just that, when you look at the actual epidemiology, and you look at research across the world, 15, 18 months now, we knew that children had almost no risk of being infected and transmitting it to other kids and even taking it home. So we have that data. We have the actual data, but we actually have biological molecular studies that show this. So I agree in a sense that something other than science is at play here. This is not science anymore. This is a dangerous situation. This is about money, big money. I don't know how come doctors would just go along with this and be so silent and even partake. So as I said, in the end, it's not just about your conscience anymore. These people must know that you can't introduce something that has no proper safety record, no meaningful safety information into children who bring no risk. And you're going to potential. Look, if you look in historically, we had this situation with the RSV, the RSV vaccine in 1960s. We had the H1N1 2009 vaccine in narcolepsy. The RSV one caused Guillain-Barre. We have damaged a lot of children. We have the dengue vaccine 2017 in the Philippines for dengue that killed a bunch of children. That had to be pulled. So all of these showed ADE, antibody-dependent enhancement, etc. So we have all of this information. We have the evidence. We had tainted polio in the past. So it's not that anything anybody is making up. In this case, we know that COVID has spared our children, unlike, let's say, seasonal influenza. And Dr. Martin McCarry out of Johns Hopkins they have been hammering the CDC about getting the information as to whether any deaths that they have recorded in children, I think about 350 deaths in America, were they causal or incidental to COVID. But what he did with, and his team, and he has stated this, that they looked at all of the instances where the 250 deaths that CDC and they have logged as due to COVID, and they found not one child that was not healthy. So the reality is these were children who had problems, and any death of a child is tragic. I have children, young children too. I couldn't live if something happened to my child. But we have to be honest and fair with the reporting and accurate. And if this is the case, we are talking about high-risk children. You're not talking about the general population of mainly 99.99% of healthy children. You can't vaccinate children just because you just created a vaccine and now you're going to make a bunch of money. You can't. Not one of these public health officials, Fauci or the NIAID, Francis Collins or the NIH, Rochelle Walensky, CDC, not one of them, none, not even in the Trump administration, Redfield in the past, but actually I don't think he was a big vaccine advocate. But those who were pushing it, not one of the vaccine developers, none of the Slowy from Moderna, none of them have prosecuted a case and have made a case as to why children should be vaccinated. And my argument to them today is this: if you people are so sure that these vaccines are safe, if you want to get into the arms of our children, then you take liability protection off the table. You are protected by liability protection. So if you figure this thing works and it's so safe and non-consequential, well, be a big man and woman about it. Bring liability protection to the discussion and remove it. Tell us you're going to remove it. Stand behind your vaccine and be willing. If there's no risk, then you should have no consequences. But should any child, one child, I am saying, if one child dies from these vaccines, we should shut the nation down. Because I and McCullough and Rich and Bhattacharya, we have been on the news, on Fox, we are writing, we are saying children will die. Not children may die. Children will die. There will be deaths from these vaccines. We are telling the public ahead of time. Fauci and they know this. So we need to stop it. If we proceed and we can't get it stopped, hold these people to account. Shut the country down. Go to Washington. Put your tools down. This is what I am saying. Put your tools down. Shut the country down. Let nothing move until you fire these people, because we are telling you ahead of time, I've written it, children will die from these vaccines. Which child? I don't know. But if adults have died from them, and we know that, it's in the CDC's database. If so many people have been affected, children have been spared so far because they've not been vaccinated, do not vaccinate them. They do not have risk to warrant it. And if they go forward, I'm saying it again, they must be, Fauci and these people must be held to account. Not a simple, sorry, we didn't know, or we just found out, yes, the vaccine, let's stop the vaccine now. No, 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 no. They know. If any child dies, hold them to account. Strip them of everything. Take their homes, take their pensions, do everything you could. Because these people know what they're doing is wrong. This is not a mistake. Oh, oops, sorry. No, 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 no. It's not a simple mea culpa. We need to get to the place where we hold people to account for these devastating decisions that they're making. And this is a devastating one. No child should be touched with the vaccines, period. Unless they take liability protection off the table that protects them, and they will not. That's why I'm being... I'm playing a game with my language. I know they won't, because they know they will have their children. But that's what parents should say. Take it off. Then we will talk about vaccines. And that should tell parents where we are. They will refuse to do that. They wouldn't even answer you. And that's where it is. So I don't mind if we set another call, another interview, but I have
You've got to go.
Another interview.
Can you
and
tell
I
folks?
Very much apologize.
No, no. Thank you very much for your time. I know the Brownstone Institute is one place where you write your op-eds. Is that the best place for people to follow you if they're interested in following
yes,
your work?
Yes, yes. Yes, and I'm going to put out a website in the next couple of days where people could also follow my work directly. But yes, I do write. I'm a scholar at the Brownstone Good Institute. A good place, very brilliant people, Mr. Jeff Tucker, he heads that. That's his creation. Excellent individual, very bright. And there's a lot of work out there now. Please, people just need to read and be informed and be willing and be brave.
Amen. Brownstone.org, guys, that's the website you can go. And
there's
multiple op-eds about Dr. Paul Elias Alexander. You can look it up on that brownstone.org. Dr. Alexander, thank you for your time today. And more importantly, thank you for your efforts and your commitment to humanity and to people. And thank you for coming
no,
on board
I,
and,
listen,
and
so,
giving it
ben,
good
I,
advice.
You're an expert. You've probably done more in doing. You know, I'm just very privileged and honored to be talking to you on your show, to whomever's listening. I am. I'm very fortunate to be alive. We have a serious, serious problem, and we need to make a decision. How are we going to step up to help? Whether you're writing something, you're speaking out, you're sharing information with your neighbors, your friends, but this could only fix if we inform each other, you know, properly. And I very much, very much appreciate the honor and privilege to have spoken to you. And I don't mind coming back on, you know. It's just right now, too, is a lot of different interviews and stuff. So,
well, we're so grateful for your time, grateful for all your knowledge, for your analysis of the situation, for your efforts. Please give our best regards to your family. I know they've sacrificed, too, with you working so hard and being out of the home and giving to the country so much. So thank you for your time today and,
thank you,
and
sir.
Over the past 18 months.
Thank you, and we'll talk again. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, that was Dr. Paul Alexander again. Brownstone.org is where you can go follow his op-eds and look at all the science that he puts out there in his articles. Again, he's an evidence-based medicine researcher, so he tries to follow the data and follow the evidence. And just to summarize, his interpretation and analysis of the evidence over the past 18 months is that lockdowns don't work, and not only do they not work, they create more harm, sickness, and death than if we would not have locked down. His analysis of the mask data shows that masks are not effective in mitigating this pandemic, and in fact can cause a person to be sicker and be more prone to viral illnesses, respiratory illnesses. And of course, his analysis of these gene therapy injections that we're calling vaccinations are actually harming more than they're helping. This is in line with many of our other guests that we've talked to, Steve Kirsch in particular, that I believe still has the $1 million reward out there for anyone who can debunk his analysis. He and his team of 20 statisticians that have looked at the all-cause mortality. And there are others besides Steve Kirsch, obviously, but one of Steve's latest articles looks at data that analyzes in kids, the likelihood of death from the injection comes out to 117 kids will be killed by the injection for every one child saved from COVID death. Again, Steve Kirsch, you can go look him up. I'll put that on our Telegram page or just go to his website. But that's consistent with the Kostoff paper that showed a fivefold increase all-cause mortality, consistent with the Walsh paper, same thing. Even Pfizer's own initial study data showed increased all-cause mortality in the vaccinated group than the placebo group, including a fourfold increase in cardiac events. So the evidence is seems to be very clear in these areas, and at the very minimum, it's highly debatable topic. Nowhere near the point where we should be mandating anything, especially an experimental therapy that's had catastrophic failures in the past when they've tried to do coronavirus vaccines and when they've tried to do this particular gene therapy, mRNA transfer technology. Moderna always had to stop their trials because of adverse events and poor efficacy, and have still yet to prove that they've overcome those challenges. Not to mention it's illegal, unethical, and immoral to mandate emergency authorized medical therapy on anybody. So how could all this be? How could we be where we're at right now in America and in the world in general? And that's a question you'll just have to discern yourself, because at some point we have to get out of data and quote unquote science and get above all that, I believe, and have more of a spiritual discernment. So personally, my discernment tells me that it appears there are many, many people in the world that have put unwavering and unquestionable trust in these institutions. Historically, we've just trusted all these healthcare institutions and just can't even fathom that these institutions could get it wrong, or that when they have, do get it wrong, and it's so obvious they've gotten it wrong, that they wouldn't repent, they wouldn't confess, they wouldn't, you know, how could they ignore what they've gotten wrong and allow something to continue that is potentially harming people? We just can't fathom that. We've put so much blind hope, faith, and trust into these institutions. So let me just speak to the believers out there, the believers in the truth, the way of Jesus. And my real encouragement to you is to take captive every thought you have, as Scripture tells us to do, and hold it up to Scripture. Have the standard be the book of truth. The standard be Jesus and the way that Jesus lived, the way he thought, taught, acted, and treated others, and the way he taught us to treat others. Love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, but also love your neighbors yourself. And that's pretty much wraps it up right there. Just do those two things. And when our thinking doesn't line up with the ways of Jesus, then we need to confess that, turn around, and line it back up. For instance, if a thought comes in your head that is based in fear, then you're not walking in the way of Jesus, and you need to turn around and go back to his way. So fear of death, fear of sickness, fear of COVID, fear of any germ. Heard Bill Gates say, watch out, a smallpox epidemic or pandemic could be coming right around the corner. I've heard about this new Marburg, hemorrhagic gastroenteritis type of bug, similar to Ebola. And I'm sure there's others out there that we'll be hearing about that are just looming out there in the darkness, ready to become a worldwide pandemic. And it may be. Those may emerge somehow. But that's not going to knock God off his throne. He's still in charge. There's nothing in the world that could happen that God doesn't know about, doesn't allow for his purposes, which will all work for the good of those who love him, and those who love him, trust him, and walk in the ways of Jesus. So that's my encouragement. Watch your fruit, but behind the fruit in your life is thoughts. Your thinking is so big. So take captive those thoughts. And if you're letting money influence your decision, then I would submit to you to consider you might not be walking in the ways of Jesus. God in the kingdom of truth and light, in God's kingdom, he owns it all. He made it all. He owns it all. And if you're submitted to him and you're his child, loving and trusting him, then he will provide for you. We don't have to scrounge for our own provision or our own protection. The orphan spirit, which is not from the kingdom of truth and light and love, the orphan spirit will tell you, you have to protect yourself and provide for yourself. Your identity is not firmly seated in Christ and in the heavenly realm. That's the orphan spirit. And that's not the truth. The truth is you're a child of God. If you've submitted to Jesus and to your heavenly Father, he'll provide and protect. So you don't have to be fearful of losing your job, being fired, not being provided for. You don't need to fear that your kids are going to be growing up in this world right now. God would not have put us into the earth at this moment in time if he didn't equip us with all that we will need to live and not only live, but thrive, and to walk in his ways peacefully. Because the kingdom of God is not about food or drink, but righteousness, peace, and joy. And when we line those thoughts up in right alignment with the truth, peace and joy will attend us, despite our circumstances. So as things get crazier and tighter and harder, I just got noticed that the little glass tubes that we do blood draws, when we check people's blood work, we have to draw the blood out, put it into these little test tubes, and send it to Quest. And we were just informed that there's a worldwide shortage on these test tubes. And I don't know, that may resolve in a day or two, or it may not resolve for many months. Who knows, the way the world is right now. But that shouldn't elicit fear in anybody. What if we run out of IV tubing and we can't do vitamin C drips anymore? That shouldn't elicit fear. What if ivermectin gets back ordered or completely banned, or every other therapeutic that we think is beneficial? We still won't walk in fear. God brought manna from the sky to his children who were in the wilderness. And so if it takes an eagle dropping a steak right on my front door for my supper tonight, that's what it'll take. But God will provide. So be at peace, be encouraged. God's not going to leave you or forsake you if you're submitted to him. And if you're not submitted to him, I would encourage you to seek him out and talk to him and ask him to reveal himself to you. And for those that do say they're seeking him, be careful in your thinking. The enemy is going to try to steal, kill, and destroy and deceive and trick and get you to submit to his authority, his kingdom of fear in your thinking. So if you've been caught up in the wrong thinking, confess it and turn and go the other way. So it's an exciting time to be alive, guys. Be encouraged. Hang in there. We'll be back next week with another great show. Y'all stick with us. Next week, we'll be here for you. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards. You're the cure. See you next time.